You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we take stock of the biggest stories in the world that are concerning policymakers and politicians from Brussels to Beijing. Tom Wales from the think tank Oxford Analytica will be joining me for a whirlwind geopolitical tour. Then Jonathan Openshaw will be talking to our Asia Bureau Chief, Fiona Wilson, about the Japanese luxury market.
The overall picture is that the luxury market has bounced back, and nobody was really expecting that.
And we'll be heading to Vienna to find out what's brewing at the World Barista Championships, which get underway today. We'll also be chatting to Alex Duval-Smith, who's just touched down in Swaziland. We'll be finding out about the Documenta 13 exhibition in Germany, and I'll be playing you a couple of songs, including a live Midori House session by BT Wolf. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So, as ever, rather a lot to pack in. But before all that, here's Vaughan Savage with the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News at 6 o'clock. The UN peacekeeping chief says the conflict in Syria is now a full-scale civil war, and the government has lost large chunks of territory in some cities. At the same time, rebels in Syria's embattled western town of Hafa say they are desperately trying to smuggle out civilians trapped amid heavy shelling. UN monitors have said the violence made it too dangerous for them to approach the area. Opposition fighters say that hundreds of rebels have joined a 15-month-old uprising against President Bashar al-Assad and are bearing the brunt of a tank and helicopter-backed assault on their district. Meanwhile, a spokesman for the international mediator Kofi Annan says he hopes to convene a meeting of an international contact group on Syria soon. The United Nations Children in Armed Conflict report was released today, blasting Syria for the use of children as human shields. Thousands of Russians have attended a march through Moscow to protest against President Vladimir Putin, ignoring his tough new tactics intended to quash any challenge to his rule. Protesters streamed down central Moscow streets in the first major rally since Putin was sworn in on May 7th, refusing to be intimidated by police raids on opposition leaders' homes and a new law stiffening fines for public order offences. Opposition leaders say about 60 to 70,000 people turned out, much higher than the police estimate of 18,000. NATO has agreed to stop launching air raids near Afghan homes. 18 civilians, mostly women and children, were killed in a recent raid, provoking fresh anger at foreign forces. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has repeated her demand for stronger integration within the Eurozone. At a meeting of her CDU party in Berlin, she said she wanted a Europe in which accountability and joint control were always in the same hand. She added that accountability could not be a common task, with control left to national responsibility. The German Chancellor praised Spain's decision to request EU aid to recapitalise its banks. Diesel engine exhausts cause cancer in humans, according to World Health Organization experts. The announcement is likely to cause consternation among car and truck makers, as the International Agency for Research on Cancer, IARC, stated that diesel has definite links to cancer. The IARC says their working group found that diesel exhaust is a cause of lung cancer and also noted a positive association with an increased risk of bladder cancer. The group said petrol or gasoline exhaust fumes should be classified as probably carcinogenic to humans. A lawyer for the former Ukrainian Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko says the country's president is using the Euro 2012 soccer tournament in the same way as Hitler used the 1936 Olympics to claim his country's democratic credentials. Sergei Vlasenko said he hoped Western leaders would help free Ms. Tymoshenko.
Olympics of 1936 was very good for Adolf Hitler, And I think that absolutely in this way that soccer championship is good for Yanukovych. The main issue that the innocent person is sitting in the jail for 10 months already. Everyone here understands that that's a political repressions. They have nothing to do with the law and with the judiciary.
Meanwhile, there have been clashes between Russian and Polish fans in Warsaw ahead of their Group A Euro 2012 game. And the European football's governing body is to investigate two cases of alleged racist chanting at games at the Euro 2012 championships in Poland. Over 30 years after the case made headlines around the world, a coroner in Australia has ruled that 9-week-old Azaria Chamberlain died after a dingo dog took her from a campsite near Ayers Rock. The baby went missing in 1980. Her mother, Lindy, was jailed for life for her murder, but released 3 years later. Lindy Chamberlain says she's relieved that the saga is finally over.
No longer will Australia be able to say that dingoes are not dangerous and only attack if provoked. We live in a beautiful country, but it is dangerous. And we would ask all Australians to be aware of this and take appropriate precautions and not wait for somebody else to do it for them.
After the Ukraine's victory over Sweden last night in the Euro 2012 soccer championships, the Ukraine's premier striker was struck. Well, his vehicle was. Returning home from the game in which he scored twice, Andriy Shevchenko's car was hit from behind when he stopped at a traffic light. The player is unhurt. And that's the main news this hour on Monocle 24.
Vaughan, thank you very much. It's 18:06 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Hong Kongist ja Tokios. Siin on Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Ви слушаєте Monocle 24.
Λόντοστα καζίν, τämä on Monocle 24.
London Bo, as a Monocle 24.
Λόντζοντα, Burası, Monocle 24.
Londonist, siin on Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que você está ouvindo é Monocle 24.
Isso é o Monocle 24.
Você ouve Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes este Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24-tagatja.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. Over the past few days, several of the world's most pressing problems appear to have reached potential turning points, from the Spanish bailout to Syria's deepening civil war to concerns over growth in China and India. Working out what happens next is a question that is giving policymakers across the world sleepless nights, seemingly endless sleepless nights. The UK-based think tank Oxford Analytica, whose weekly Outlook note lands in the inbox of numerous diplomats, economists and politicians across the world, has been trying to answer those questions. And I'm pleased to say the group's Deputy Director of Analysis, Tom Wales, joins me in the studio now. Tom, welcome to Midori House.
Happy to be here.
I want to do a little bit of a quick tour of the world's hotspots, both political and economic. Let's start with China, which has its fair share of both political and economic challenges at the moment, does it not?
It does. It does indeed. It has a problem with slowing growth, which everybody's been following very closely, and an equally high profile, I wouldn't say problem, but nervous-making incident, and that is the leadership transition, which we're coming up to very shortly. The problem for me and for a lot of analysts in looking at China is that it's extremely hard to understand exactly what the deliberations are at the highest levels of government. We talk to central bank officials. We talk to Chinese corporate officials. But in terms of the crucial body, which is the Politburo Standing Committee, that's kind of a black box for absolutely everybody. And basically, anybody who claims who knows what they're going on is probably lying, because it really is extremely difficult to interpret. So it's kind of modern day Kremlinology. This is one of the last vestiges thereof.
And how do you go about piecing it together? But before we get onto actually the substance of what it is you're trying to piece together, I mean, if you're speaking to different officials that are not necessarily the decision makers and analysts that are perhaps involved in some way, but not really making the decisions. Is it just sort of basically about having educated guesses?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we know pretty much who each of the individuals are who are moving up. Some of them are already on the standing committee, so we know them pretty well. But in Chinese politics these days, it's sort of a weird combination of what we would recognize as politics. So people do sort of campaign. I mean, not really in ways that we'd recognize. They kind of build glamour projects like giant dams, or they, you know, make tours of villages and that sort of thing. But, you know, of course, nobody is voting for any of these people. So what you have to do is you look at their background, you kind of look at the way they've behaved in other public offices, because you don't just suddenly end up leading China out of nowhere.
No, you'll have run a state or a city or at least something beforehand.
Exactly. And you'll have a background. I mean, everybody talks about these princelings, that is Chinese officials who are descended from revolutionary China era, communist revolution era Chinese officials. Mm. But still, it's extremely difficult to piece together what's going on. And the main thing that concerns me, and actually most people who look at China, is what would happen if there ever were a major disagreement between these top officials on the standing committee. The last time we had one of those was 1989. Mm. But the last time that happened, China also had this sort of godlike figure in Deng Xiaoping, who was still alive, who could kind of show up, say, okay, we're going to crack down. You guys on the standing committee who disagree with me, well, you're going into an unpleasant place, whether it be house arrest or somewhere worse. Those guys who do agree with me, well, you now have the reins. There's no final arbiter now. And this is what really worries everybody. This is what really concerned everybody with the Bo Xilai case. This is a guy who was in the Politburo. He was a candidate for promotion and came unstuck in spectacular fashion. We don't have time to get into the details there.
No, as fascinating as they are. I mean, when you look at the Bo Xilai case and what that's sort of thrown up, really, because it is one of those very rare occasions you get a real window into what's happening at the upper echelons in China. What do you think that it's the current Politburo's handling of that case it shows us about what's going on behind the scenes?
Well, I think among the current generation of officials, and this is both reassuring and not very reassuring, kind of making the fewest waves is the kind of best way to ensure your promotion and ensure your kind of political future, if that's even the term. The thing about Bo Xilai is that he was very flamboyant for a Chinese leader. He's essentially started, you know, did this really high profile crackdown on corruption in Chongqing, which involved all kinds of nasty stuff, sort of some stuff that was extremely brutal in terms of his treatment of alleged criminals. He also started this kind of back to Mao semi-cult. I think that's too strong a term, but nevertheless.
Mm, but the Little Red Book was back. And
yeah, exactly. So, I mean, when you look at, someone like Bohr, you know, on the one hand, this is a guy who probably it's a good thing that he didn't make the top group. On the other hand, the fact is that prizing consensus is a good thing, except maybe in times of crisis, when first you end up with fractures, and second, you need people to be a little bit daring, which actually leads us into some of our other topics, I guess.
Well, indeed. Just one final thing on China. When we're looking at sort of the next 3 months leading up to October, when they're going to make this or supposed to be making these changes in leadership, we touched on the fact that growth is slowing. I mean, it's still pretty decent growth compared to, we'll come on to Europe in a moment, but it's still pretty decent. I mean, what do you think are the key things for us to be looking out for in the next few months?
Well, I mean, it may seem like decent growth, but the thing about China is that, given that, all these revolutionaries have passed away, you're basically sole source of legitimacy is continued economic growth. It's like basically driving a car that only has an accelerator. And so there's only one way to respond to basically all challenges, and that is to essentially jump on the accelerator. You know, China doesn't really have a conventional monetary policy, so the fact that they lowered rates recently is just a signal. And the signal is the government will do whatever is necessary in order to maintain growth, job creation, keep up with people's expectations. This is a great thing until you finally can't do it anymore. And that's what worries people about China. When they finally run out of rope, when they finally overbuild, when the sort of bubble finally bursts, and then, you know, in some countries, well, there's a democratic process, which can be ugly, as we'll get to. But in China, there is no transparent process. Nobody knows, you know, exactly how the government will react. I think for the next 3 months, though, we're okay, you know.
Okay, good. Let's move on now to an economy that certainly doesn't have any sort of accelerator at all, or if it is, no one can really find it, and that's Europe. Obviously, it seems like every weekend is a crucial weekend in Europe. Last weekend it was because of Spain and the bailout. This weekend it's going to be because of Greece and the elections. Again, looking forward to the months ahead, what are the key moments for you? And is there anything that you think is going to, any particular event which can, you know, really bring things to a head for good or bad?
Well, I mean, the first and most obvious event happens this Sunday, and that is the Greek elections, where you have, well, first I should preface this by saying that I have a friend who's a U.S. Marine who says that combat, for those of us who haven't experienced it, is 95% incredible boredom and 5% absolute terror. And I think actually that's a pretty good description of the Euro crisis.
And it's both boring and terrifying at the same time.
Exactly. And actually we're fortunately for you guys in the media, we're headed back into another terrifying stage, which is centered around this weekend's election.
At least the terrifying stages people seem to take notice of.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, exactly.
Be grateful for small mercies. I mean, when you know, a lot of people we talk to say, well, look, the reason why the whole European economy can't fall apart is because it can't fall apart. They must be able to sort it out because the alternative is just too frightening. Does that sound sensible? Well, obviously, it's not sensible. Does that sound realistic to you?
Well, see, what, to kind of put my nerd hat on for the moment, what we're dealing with is a contingent, what we call a contingent series of risks. So basically, the problem here is that basically you have one risk, that is the risk that Greece may leave the euro, which actually looks pretty likely now for all kinds of reasons. And that leads people to kind of look at the end of the contingent series. Greece leaves, then maybe market pressure increases on the bonds of the rest of the periphery, which leaves the big European creditors, principally Germany, to finally say, "No, you guys are out of here. We're not playing anymore." The problem with the contingent series is that each time that you move down the series gives more time for a reaction. And actually more pressure for reaction. So while we may see Greece leave the euro, the fact is that the damage of a euro breakup would be so catastrophic, not, you know, including to the major creditor countries like Germany, that it gives a kind of overwhelming incentive to sort of take action. What I'll say is that what it comes down to is this. There are all kinds of acronyms and all kinds of confusing things that are going on. The real question that you want to ask, and the real question that I ask myself, is whether European policymakers have kind of the guts. I don't know. That's kind of an Americanism.
No, I know what you mean.
Yeah. Have the kind of, ability to go pirate style and break out of the kind of web of treaties and constraints to action and invent solutions that are not sort of illegal, but they're extra legal. Mm. In other words, they're improvised solutions to the crisis at hand. This is something that I think we've seen the ECB done, so I think we can have confidence there. But as to European leaders, I think that's the unanswered question.
Just quickly before we move on to your final issue, I mean, do you worry that the insistence, particularly from Germany, to stick to the rules, come what may, could end up being their undoing?
I think it could be, but I think what it's more likely to lead to is the growing consensus now, and that is a smaller eurozone with a tighter set of rules, which leads to all kinds of complications for those left on the outside, but also some kind of significant sacrifices by those on the inside.
Okay, just finally, you said before we went on air, of all the topics you want to talk about, the most exciting one was commodity prices. I'm not convinced, but I'll give you 30 seconds to wow us with why commodity prices matter right now.
Well, commodity prices right now are kind of like housing, the U.S. housing market in 2007. You know, they've been going up for a really long time. You know, they're at near record levels, or have been for a very long time. Now, in recent months, there's been a kind of softening. And everybody's saying, you know, just like in 2007 in the U.S., well, they're just getting a little bit softer. But, you know, demand in China will always be there. And, you know, things can only, you know, start going back up again. I think demand in China long-term will be there. I mean, something like 75 to 85% of new oil demand, for instance, comes from China alone. Mm. But if you get a small decrease in demand, and what we're seeing is ongoing increases in supply, even, you know, given falls in Sudan and Iran and et cetera, so you widen the band between supply and demand a little bit, you can end up with a major correction. And there's so many countries around the world that have experienced robust growth over the last decade because of commodity prices in Africa, in the Gulf, Australia, which is often described as a bubble on top of a bubble because of its relationship with China. So, I mean, this is the thing that I think would really hit people sideways.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Tom Wales from Oxford Analytica, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture. From the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
And you're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. The tiny kingdom of Swaziland is Africa's last absolute monarchy. Ruled by King Mswati III, who's been on the throne since 1986, its population of 1 million mainly lives in the countryside and is suffering a serious AIDS epidemic. King Mswati's behaviour certainly doesn't help matters. He has 17 wives and is looking for an 18th. Although he still has some way to go to beat his father, King Sobhuza II, who gathered, if that's the right word, scores of wives during his 61-year reign. Last year, there was a degree of hope that we might witness a Swazi spring, but protests from trades unionists and opposition parties, both banned, of course, have been quelled. Our Cape Town correspondent Alex Duval-Smith has just landed in Swaziland, and she joins us on the line now from the capital, Mbabane. Alex, thank you very much for joining us today. Tell us then a little bit more about King Mswati and his 17 wives. He's looking for his 18th at the moment, is he not?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, to find a raunchier script to a soap opera, you'd be hard pressed than to come to Swaziland and look at the way the royal family functions here. King Mswati III, who's 43 years old, every year holds a reed dance at which scantily clad virgins swoon around him until he picks one for his future wife, and so it goes on every year. King Mswati also has a rather extravagant lifestyle, a lot of cars. When he had his 40th birthday a few years ago, he spent about 8 million euros on that. And the stories are endless. And a lot of the local media are filled with palace intrigue. Mm. We had a few months ago the Queen having an affair with the finance minister, who was then locked in the Queen Mother's palace for several weeks.
And this is the one who was found inside the cupboard, inside the chest of drawers, hiding.
Yes.
Not a good way to be found by your king. Alex says, I mean, you've been, you know, in this region for several years. You've been covering Swaziland as part of your beat. I mean, do you get any sense that that changes could be imminent, that there may be sort of some sort of relenting to the pressure from people calling for some semblance of democracy?
Well, regrettably not. I mean, for years it's been the same thing. As journalists, we sit at our computers and receive press releases daily about human rights abuses from the Swaziland Solidarity Network and Pudemo, the trade union, calling for demonstrations. In fact, there's one tomorrow, a teachers' strike tomorrow. They're calling for 4.5% pay rise. It'll be interesting to see what the turnout is. Yes, last year there was an attempt at something a little bit more muscular to stand up to the king, but there seems to be in Swaziland the same feeling that there always has been, which is that people are unhappy, but because the kingdom is so strongly identified with the absolute monarch, that is effectively its identity, and Swaziland, without that, without the absolute monarch, so therefore with democracy, would have to find a whole new identity. It doesn't feel like it's ready for change.
When you look at the country's finances, they are not in a very good state at all. And that leaves the outside world, Western donors in particular, with a bit of a sort of an odd situation. Do they come in with funding for medicine, particularly given the AIDS epidemic, or do they feel that might be in some way propping up a dictator? How do they square that circle?
Well, I mean, South Africa, actually, in particular, came up against that very conundrum at this time last year when Swaziland had no money to buy antiretrovirals, and King Mswati, through his connections with the Zulu royal family, managed to get the South African government to agree to a loan, an unsecured loan, and that was eventually blocked. Because South Africans stood up and said, especially the South African unions and other parts of the ANC that aren't Zulu, said, you know, this is an undemocratic country and we are propping it up. The donors, on the other hand, the Western donors, the international donors, kind of have to be here because this is the place with the world's highest HIV prevalence. You know, it's got 30% unemployment, 30% people living in poverty, 30% of people HIV positive, and with no structure. I mean, last year, for example, many social grants were cancelled, old age pensions, child support. They were just cancelled because there wasn't any money in the treasury. So donors are in a conundrum, and I think it's an ongoing one. I think if it wasn't for HIV, in a way, they would have to be very much harsher on King Mswati. But, I mean, they have to save lives.
Alex Saville-Smith in Swaziland, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. And we're going to stay in Swaziland for a moment and hear some music from a Swazi songstress. Nancy G headlined at the Bushfire Festival last month. That's Swaziland's annual festival of the arts, which I'm sure you knew. And here she is with When I Woke Up This Morning, taken from her debut album, The Offering.
When I woke up this morning, I was searching for my song, and the spirit that was calling out to me.
That was When I Woke Up This Morning by Nancy G and the Human Family. In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be hearing how Japan's luxury market is doing 15 months after tsunami. We'll see what's happening at the World Barista Championships in Vienna. And we'll hear how the massive Documenta 13 contemporary art exhibition has changed the city of Kassel in Germany. But first, here's Vaughan Savage with the news headlines.
The UN peacekeeping chief says the conflict in Syria is now a full-scale civil war and the government has lost large chunks of territory in some cities. At the same time, rebels in Syria's embattled western town of Hafa say they are desperately trying to smuggle out civilians trapped amid heavy shelling. Thousands of Russians have attended a march through Moscow to protest against President Vladimir Putin, ignoring his tough new tactics intended to quash any challenge to his rule. Excuse me. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has repeated her demand for stronger integration within the Eurozone. She said she wanted a Europe in which accountability and joint control were always in the same hand. Diesel engine exhausts cause cancer in humans, according to World Health Organization experts. The International Agency for Research on Cancer says that diesel has definite links to cancer. There have been clashes between Russian and Polish fans in Warsaw ahead of their Group A Euro 2012 game, and the European football's governing body is to investigate two cases of alleged racist chanting. And finally, over 30 years after the case made headlines around the world, a coroner in Australia has ruled that 9-week-old Azaria Chamberlain died after a dingo dog took her from a campsite near Ayers Rock. And that's the news at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Vaughan. Now, every day here on Midori House, we summon one of Monocle's editors to talk us through some of the bigger stories on their patch. It's Tuesday, which means it's the turn of our business editor, Jonathan Openshaw. In Japan, the luxury market seems to be back on track. According to a recent study by McKinsey, the nation's luxury market appears to have almost fully recovered following last year's tsunami. A little earlier, Jonathan spoke to our Tokyo bureau chief, Fiona Wilson.
Well, this is a report that McKinsey has come out with, and it's actually the fourth year they've done this. It's called the Japan Luxury Consumer Survey. And I think what's interesting about this one is that it comes at the end of a very, very bad year in 2011. And the overall picture is that the luxury market has bounced back. Nobody was really expecting that. Sales were really in the doldrums after March the 11th, 2011. And what this survey is showing is that 20 CEOs of Japan-based luxury companies said that actually results are going to be much better in 2012 than last year, and nearly three-quarters of them said it had made no difference. The events of last year had made no difference to their results.
It's interesting. I mean, the growth's not only matched pre 2011 levels, but actually in some areas started to outstrip it as well. What are some of the, are we talking about across the whole luxury industry here, or are there particular goods or areas that seem to be a focus of this bounce back?
Well, everyone's been talking about luxury watches recently. I feel every magazine I open or every TV program seems to be focusing on this, because I think it's partly a result again of the earthquake, but there was a psychological impact. One was that people weren't spending money after the earthquake, immediately after the earthquake. They held back. There's a lot of talk about jishoku, self-restraint. And when they did start spending again, then they were looking for something a bit more long-term, a bit more solid. It was something of an investment. And so watches have been shown to be a very good product to buy at the moment. And the other thing is cars, which slightly unexpected. I wouldn't say it's a long-term product, but companies like Mercedes-Benz have been reporting amazing figures for the first quarter of this year, far exceeding previous years. They went over 10,000 units, I think, between January and March this year, and that was really unexpected, I think, probably for them. And I think that, again, is partly the psychological impact of what happened last year. And there's a lot of talk about people wanting to maybe spend at the top end and save at the bottom, but they want to buy high quality products.
I mean, it's interesting, you mentioned the bottom end there, and it was interesting to see from this survey as well that those kind of really, you know, the bottom end, very, very kind of value for money has also seems to have been thriving. And perhaps you're seeing this this divide, which we've seen in other markets of late, where it's kind of the middle ground that's actually left really exposed. The top end luxury doing great, it seems, bottom end value for money goods thriving, and it's the middle range businesses which might be at risk.
Definitely, that I've heard a lot of people saying that exact thing. I mean, you find if you go along the high street, you'll see there's a pharmacy you see here a lot called Matsumoto Kiyoshi. That does very, very well. It's very well priced. You also get places like Yoshinoya. These are very cheap lunch places. Now, somebody with a Louis Vuitton handbag would have no problem having their lunch at Yoshinoya. Cheap bowl of rice and beef. No, you know, there's no problem with that. It's saving at the bottom so that you can spend at the top.
With their pampered toy dog, no doubt. In tow. It was another thing, online retailing. This was a focus that they looked at. Although it, you know, huge in Japan as it is in all East Asian markets at the moment, but not making a huge impact on the luxury market.
Yeah, I mean, it's really huge here now. It's something like 10 trillion yen, I think, the latest figures. It's so enormous, and it's interesting that
in a way, I feel the luxury market is missing a trick here, because particularly women who, according to the McKinsey report, are making up 75% of luxury sales in Japan, they're big online shoppers. So in a way, the luxury market could combine their sales with a target audience there. And the other target audience is the 20-something audience, which is also very obviously big on online shopping. The figures show that. And they're also being shown to be surprisingly the most active percentage-wise, the most active group in terms of luxury spending. Is something like, I think, 5%, it said in the McKinsey report, 5% of 20-somethings are involved in some way in buying things in the luxury market. So online retailing would obviously make sense, but I think there's a bit of resistance to that, partly because you miss the experience of being in the shop.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, picking up on something that I noticed in when we were at the FT Business of Luxury conference last week in Marrakesh, and a big discussion was about this slightly post kind of e-commerce hangover, slight disillusionment perhaps with how for business it's great, but potentially for your brand it's not. And there was a real return to talking about the importance of bricks and mortar and having your flagship and setting up your shop. Obviously Japan's led the way in with service culture in the past. Are you feeling that there's a kind of return to a really strong sense of service culture? Perhaps is that why e-commerce isn't making the inroads that it might be in the luxury industry?
Well, I think the, you know, as you say, the service here is so extraordinary, and it's taken to a sort of quite ridiculous level when you go into a luxury shop. And I think people are, when they buy, an Hermes handbag, they want the full service. I think, you know, it's part of the experience. And I think the really successful online retailers are at the lower end, not the lowest end. So we're not talking H&M, Uniqlo. It's more the sort of middle market, the United Arrows, the Beams. They do very well online. And I think it's just not really tried and tested for the luxury market. And I think what they would probably find is exactly what happens with people like United Arrows, is that shoppers are very happy to, they'll go into the stores, they'll feel the products, they'll have a look, and then maybe they'll go and order them on their mobile phones. It would be good for the company if they were still at least buying the product. So I think, you know, that maybe people would go, they want to go into the Louis Vuitton store or the Dior shop, have a look at the bag. It's usually a bag. And then maybe think about it at home. You know, there could be a double experience of going into a shop and then buying it online.
Mm. And so finally, quickly, is there any kind of future predictions from the report, any kind of forecasting of confidence or growth?
Yes, I think, I mean, again, the McKinsey report is very positive. It's looking at ahead. It's saying that there is an audience of people that maybe haven't really been targeted so far who, you know, and they look at men, actually. It's interesting. They said that a very interesting figure where they say 3 million men under the age of 34 are living alone, and their average income has actually increased last year by 7%, and so did their spending is also up. So it's saying that there's potential growth.
And that was Monocle's Asia Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson speaking to our business editor, Jonathan Openshaw. You're listening to Midori House.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
It's that time of year when City Hall officials dab their concerned brows and mayors worry if they've raised their game enough to get a mention. That's because Monocle's bumper annual quality of life survey is hitting newsstands with its ranking of the top 25 cities to call home. Pick up your copy to see whether your town is a magnetic metropolis or a city on the slide. The July-August double issue comes with many more surprises too, from five cities that are never going to win on metrics, but which we love anyway, 10 inspiring leaders you should know, and 50 things to improve your life. And our editors have been busy rounding up many more reports. Steve, what's in the affairs pages?
This month we sit down with the Mayor of New York, Mike Bloomberg. we showcase some of the best concierges from New York to London, and we visit a suburb with style, Wannsee, in Berlin.
You'll find all this and more in the July-August issue of Monocle that's on sale very soon.
And you should be able to pick up your bumper copy of the July-August issue of Monocle. I think a little bit later this week even, maybe, if you're very, very lucky. You're listening to Midori House. It is 1841 here in London. Now, as art festivals go, few are as expansive as Documenta, a 100-day-long fiesta in the central German city of Kassel that is widely considered to be one of the most important contemporary art exhibitions in Europe. From museums and art galleries to the train station and even hotel ballrooms, the show, which involves some 200 artists, fills the city. Held every 5 years, and now in its 13th incarnation, Documenta opened this week, and the festival's artistic director, Caroline Christoph Bakargiev, joins me now from Kassel. Caroline, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. Let's talk about the scale, first of all. I mean, this is 5 years in the making. How difficult is it to put together something so large and so sort of all-encompassing?
Thank you for that question. It's not difficult. It's challenging and a great pleasure. Kassel is normally a rather small town, let's say, so it comes alive every 5 years with Documenta. So there's a great lot of goodwill to contact all the museums and the galleries and the ballrooms, as you mentioned, and all of that. So I think the artists really love to work in Kassel because they have a lot of space and place and time to do it.
And let's talk about some of the things you're most excited about at this year's festival. I know you can't really have favourites as such, but if you were to give us two or three major highlights, if we were heading over, what would be the things to look out for?
Well, it's really hard with over 150 artists and many, many new works, new commissions for the Documenta. It's really hard to pick, but you could... you know, go from Pedro Reyes's sanatorium, which is basically a sort of a psychiatric hospital in the middle of the park that is a performative installation event where visitors can come and take therapy, basically, on one end of the whole thing, to the opposite end where William Kentridge has created his most innovative new work called The Refusal of Time. That's a multi-screen projection and installation about how to escape, let's say, the strictures of synchronization and the speed of daily life today.
And we talked about some of the unusual venues that you use. How do you sort of decide how you're going to match the artist with the venue?
That's a good question. I don't know myself. I think my subconscious does that at night. I wake up and suddenly it's absolutely right and necessary that Tino Segal do his incredible piece, this variation, in the ballroom of the Hessenland Hotel that had been renovated and redesigned by Arnold Bode, who was also the founder of the Documenta. So it's kind of going backwards and forwards and trying to match the artist's intentions with some of the other meanings that certain places and spaces have, I suppose.
And do you find that the owners of some of the more unusual spaces and places, or at least unusual when it comes to showing art, are incredibly receptive to the things that you suggest, you know, they should be home to?
Well, sometimes. I mean, I wanted to do a piece deep embedded into the tunnels under the Weinberg terraces, and that was impossible because the health and safety regulations wouldn't let us. So those kind of impediments happen where they're trying to protect our health, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I think, yeah, the Hessenland Hotel has been super receptive. The owners of the old Cascade Cinema that was built in the early 50s after World War II as a kind of shiny story, red velvet cinema with a real water curtain, and then turned into a porno cinema in the 80s and then was abandoned. They were very happy to have me, you know, re-engage with that space with Jérôme Bell's theater production for Documenta.
Now, this is going on for 100 days, but that's, you know, 100 days every 5 years. What is Kassel like now when documentary isn't on? In what ways do you think the festival has helped to change the shape of the town?
Well, when documentary is on, which is a 100-day museum, you might say, or a 100-day exhibition, as well as a festival of periodic events, performances, and so on, I think it's extremely international. It's a bit like the United Nations somehow of art. And so there's people from all over the world, from New Zealand to Norway, from Africa to Latin America here. And so it's a great place to be during the Documenta. In between the Documentas, I'm not sure. I think that Joseph Beuys's 7,000 Oaks, you know, he started planning the 7,000 Oaks near a stone in Documenta. And I think that really changed, for example, the whole industry in Kassel, because there's been a lot of alternative energy research, like the SMA company that builds solar converters. So there's actually been indirect relations that have to do with other fields as well, not just art at all. So but it's a city that comes alive every 5 years, for sure.
And during those 100 days when it is on, I mean, is there really any escape at all? I mean, do you feel like wherever you turn, you're in something to do with Documenta?
Yeah, I guess you feel that way, especially my Documenta, because I have more venues than any other Documenta. It doesn't mean I have more art in it. It's yeah. just that I didn't concentrate it as much. I don't like big shopping malls, or, you know, I don't like places where you feel obliged to experience everything. I want the visitors to be able to experience whatever they want. And so we have a great map and a great guidebook. And sometimes you'll go to one building, like the old bank Finanzamt that had been bombed during World War II, and that all was left was the vault room. And you'll find only one artwork, you know, beautiful chalk on blackboard by Tastedin. So I want people to feel that they can pick what they want to see and take it on their own time.
Well, Carolyn Christoph Bakarjiev, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House, and best of luck with the rest of the 100-day festival. That's Documenta 13 in the German city of Kassel. Now, a little earlier this afternoon, London-based singer-songwriter B.T. Wolf dropped into Midori House to play a few songs to an adoring crowd of Monocle staff for this week's Midori House Sessions. You can hear the whole session, plus B.T.'s interview with Rob, on next Monday's Culture Show, but here's a little taste. This is Thinking for Two.
Maybe I'm wrong to behave like I do. I guess I'm not used. Thinking for two. Do 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 do. And I try to think for two.
That was B.T. Wolf with Thinking for Two. You can hear me whooping in the background there. That was from her Midori House session recorded earlier this afternoon. And as I said before, you can hear more of that on Culture with Robert Bound next Monday at 1900 hours London time. You're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. The search for the perfect coffee is, for the amateur caffeine aficionado, a never-ending journey filled with mild disappointment, occasional joy, and far too many watery Starbucks. For the professionals, there's a little less of the American nonsense, but the search can prove just as elusive. In Vienna today, this year's hunt for the world's best barista got underway with the start of the World Barista Championships. And I'm delighted to be joined now from Vienna by Jamie Barnwell, one of the judges at the championships. Jamie, welcome to Midori House. Talk us through what it is you're looking for in a great barista.
Well, firstly, thanks for letting me speak to you today, Steve. It's a lot of things we're looking for, quite a few things, but first and foremost, a bit of a coffee ambassador, someone who really understands coffee as an organic product and the processes that get it to the cafe and then making it into a great espresso or great cappuccino, much the same as chefs kind of own that process of making food into something greater than the sum of its parts. what we're looking for, and first and foremost a great coffee ambassador, speciality coffee ambassador.
And I mean, there's a performance element in this as well, isn't there? It's not just about being able to, you know, turn out the perfect espresso or cappuccino, but you know, they need to be able to do it with a certain amount of style, I imagine.
Indeed, it's very intense for them. They have 15 minutes to make 4 espressos, 4 cappuccinos, and 4 speciality drinks. It's not much time at all, but their professionalism presentation is a large part of our marking process, and we mark them on that. So, and a lot of that is about how they understand the coffee, and a little bit of theatre involved in that, and we do mark that accordingly, and we're looking for a big personality as well, so it is part of the process, you're right.
And have you noticed any sort of change in the countries that excel, or the people from the countries that excel, that, you know, used to be, I don't know, someone from Colombia, but now actually you're seeing some you know, some great talent in Australia or New Zealand?
What we do see is a great increase in interest in speciality coffee across the board, and a big rise in standards from everyone. Even the little countries who, you know, traditionally have not had much access to great coffees are really raising their games. And I saw the American competitor the day after I judged, and she was fantastic, and some of the other guys. And they're really trying to push the boundaries of what's a great coffee and what's a great specialty drink, and why these things work together. And it's really interesting listening to them and their ideas. And it then trickles down to cafes and people thinking about the product and trying to get so much more out of it. And like you were saying in your intro, very much the un-Starbucks way. It's about exploring coffee.
Now, you mentioned, yeah, aside from the espressos and the cappuccinos, they have to produce their sort of signature drinks, their original signature drinks. Just finally, have there been any really exciting signature drinks you've seen so far that you think, you know, we might be finding in a coffee shop near us in a year or two's time?
That would be nice. That really would. Without tasting them, it's really tough, because you can see the thought and the dedication and the skill that goes into making them. But it ultimately, if that balance isn't there and that taste profile isn't there, we have to mark that accordingly. You know, sometimes they can look fantastic and bomb a bit, to be honest. But sometimes they become so much greater than the sum of their parts. And without tasting that, I can't say, but there were some really interesting ones today. Traditionally, 5 or 6 years ago, it used to be kind of cream and orange and, you know, very simple. But now you get people kind of deconstructing coffee, putting it back together, using chemistry sets almost, and getting really very detailed and intricate. And what we'll see is little bits of that maybe getting to the high street. And we see that with filter coffee and pour overs, which is a kind of derivative of filter coffees. And you'll see people talking about that and the taste characteristics in different coffees from different regions. And that's kind of coming from this competition, because people are finding coffees that from North Africa that taste very different from Southern and Central America to Southern America. They're all very different. That's what we want to bring to the public, the diversity in the coffee, and that it isn't all just the same. And that's what I think we're getting from this competition, slowly but surely, a realization that there's a whole coffee world out there, and we don't have to accept just simple coffee. We should expect a lot more.
Good. Okay, music to our ears. Jamie Barnwell at the World Barista Championships, thank you very much indeed. And I'm afraid that's all we've got time for on today's Midori House. The producer was Marcus Hippy, the studio manager, Toby Hammond. Up next after the news is this week's episode of Section D with Hugo MacDonald, and they'll be heading to Antwerp to attend the Royal Academy graduation show.
What for us is extremely important is the very individual approach. So we work very individual with the students. We give them the possibility to learn and work with a very strong signature.
And in 3 hours' time at 2200 hours here in London, Chloe Potter and Andrew Muller will be back for the Monocle Daily. They'll be covering the latest trouble in Syria, looking at how casual labour is underpinning the Spanish economy, and they'll also take an historical look at Afghanistan's Khyber Pass. Emma Nelson will be back in this seat with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. Until then, from all of us here at Midori House, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.